the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
If you've been listening along over the past month, what you'll have heard is the gathered wisdom of scholars from around the globe. We've been speaking with some very smart, articulate men and women for our upcoming documentary due for release next year. It's called For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined.
Yep, we've been dipping our toes into some vast topics like the Crusades and the Church's treatment of women over the centuries. It's not just because we're lazy and we want to capitalise on interviews that we've already done.
Although we do want to capitalise on the interviews.
It's not just that. We think that there's so much here that's worth sharing, and we don't want you to have to wait till the whole documentary is finished to hear some of it.
Yeah, you can catch up on previous episodes of this on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on iTunes. Just type CPX into the search box to find us. But this week, we tackle another example of where Christianity has played a role for better and worse in the history of humanity. We're talking today about slavery. Has Christianity been a friend or foe of this terrible institution?
And this is not just an historical question. There are more people in slavery today than at any point in human history, an estimated 27 million people. And the vast majority of those are women and children. So the battle against slavery is an ongoing one.
We are going to talk a little bit about continuing efforts to abolish slavery. But first we want to ask, if Christianity was so important in opposing slavery, as the scholars we spoke to all agree, why did it take so long? Why weren't Christians campaigning against it from the start? In my interview with former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, he offers a clue to this. Slavery in the ancient world, he says, was like supermarkets today, just a given. It's part of our economy, just part of the furniture. And Christian opposition to it was a very slow burn.
Although Judaism and Christianity begin in a world where, for example, slavery is taken for granted, both of them have what I sometimes call a long fuse. That is, they light a long fuse of argument and discovery, which eventually explodes and people realize, you know, actually we should do something about this. And that's how slavery is dealt with. So in the Middle Ages, you have the beginnings of a real theoretical assault on the notion of slavery. You have the recognition in the 12th century that there are aspects of human life that cannot be controlled by any other. There are decisions which can't be determined for you by somebody else. There are, ultimately, rights of conscience. So that's part of how it begins.
So even if it took a long time to challenge existing structures, where did the conviction that slavery is unacceptable come from?
It's absolutely constitutive of the Christian imagination.
This is American theologian and philosopher David Bentley Hart. He says that what the Christian gospel did was to turn the hierarchies of the ancient world upside down. The Bible claims that God took on the form of a human, Jesus, and became practically a slave himself. This is an unthinkable claim within first century culture.
In a world that believes in that at the end of the day, the index of human value and of moral truth are degrees of privilege, power, pedigree, the right to own others, to govern others, to kill others, the notion that the highest value of all begins in resigning all of that, recognizing that all claims to power, all claims to privilege and right are false and violent at the end of the day, and that God, as God, is most God when he pours himself out into nothingness, so utterly changes the expectations we have of ourselves and one another and what we dare call the good or what we dare claim for ourselves or what we dare deny to others.
Actually, one of the earliest leaders of the church in Rome was a former slave. This is how radical Christianity was. Its estimate of human value, what each and every human is worth, was revolutionary.
Yes, but there are many passages in the Bible that could be thought of as endorsing slavery, or at least seem to be not too fussed about it. We asked Old Testament scholar Ian Proven about this. If slavery is so against Christian principles, Why doesn't the Bible explicitly forbid it anywhere?
A large part of reading the Old Testament law well is to recognize the variety of things you're dealing with, as it were. So when it comes to the life of the Christian in the New Testament, I think the same is true. I mean, the apostles don't try to overturn the slave trade and so on. They restrict themselves to telling Christians how they should treat slaves better and so on. You could take that, and it has been taken, as a sanction of slavery. I don't think that's consistent with the whole story. I think we have to recognize those are temporary holding mechanisms, best case scenarios in context. In other words, law and ethics are not the same thing.
In essence, the Bible's commands to treat slaves well rather than free them reflect the constraints of the society they're in and how powerless the early Christians are. They don't have the means at this point to overturn the institution. But their claims about the human person kind of light the fuse, to go back to that image. Here's David Bentley Hart again.
Early pagan critics were aware of this. I mean, they saw it as a revolution in a sense, in terms of the claims it was making for that slaves and persons of the lowest birth and persons without status before the law were somehow actually the unique concern, the special concern, the infinite concern of God, and that these persons had access to God. I mean, this one very famous pagan critic of Christianity is just, marveled again and again that persons of such low derivation could imagine that they had access to the high God beyond all gods and temples and all the hierarchies of power. Over the centuries, one way or another, however much Christian culture and Christian peoples may have betrayed these ideals, this was the moral grammar they had. It saturated everything. It would be nice if that change had occurred more rapidly, but perhaps then it wouldn't have occurred as pervasively.
But if Christianity lit that fuse, it was also a case at times of one step forward, about 100 steps back. This is, from one perspective, one of the great shining contributions Christianity has made to our history. You look at someone like William Wilberforce, but it's also one of the most abject failures of Christians to live up to their own ideals. David Bentley Hart acknowledges this.
Obviously, the most conspicuous example of the failure of Christian values to alter the thinking of its society rapidly is a case of slavery. I mean, slavery persisted throughout late antiquity. It did die out as a chattel system in the Christianized world, principally, I think, at first because the notion of one baptized Christian owning another was considered irregular more and more, but also just because of changes in economic conditions. But slavery persisted. And many of the church fathers, lamenting it as part of the sad state of fallen humanity, but were not able to imagine a social or an economic reality in which it didn't exist. It was just an immemorial practice. But my favorite figure from the 4th century, Gregory of Nyssa, comes to mind, is an example of how disruptive the Christian moral imagination could still become. Because in 379, he preached what looks like the first abolitionist sermon. Certainly, it's a theological attack on slavery that's so uncompromising that it has absolutely no parallel anywhere in ancient literature. And we read it now, and we wonder, where did it come from? And it came from, basically, Gregory taking the gospel seriously and forgetting that he was a bishop and just remembering that he was a Christian. But as I say, I mean, it would be nice if Gregory's sermon had spawned imitators. It didn't. The church fathers are always arguing for its amelioration, for regarding slaves as brothers and sisters in Christ, for living like a family rather than like masters and servants. But the reality never reflected the ideal.
Ian Proven says the long fuse also involved people misusing and abusing the Bible for their own purposes.
Absolutely, I would acknowledge that there have been terrible failings in Christian history, but those failings are associated with bad Bible reading, in my opinion. I mean, when people take Old Testament law out of context and simply translate laws about slavery onto their statute books without thinking about where we are in this great story and who we are, or when people think that they are Israel over against the Canaanites and you take that to the New World and slaughter native populations on that basis, it's not only wicked and tragic and terrible, it's also extremely bad biblical hermeneutics.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity, and we're speaking with leading theologians and scholars from around the world about slavery, one issue that's widely considered a black mark against Christianity.
The documentary we're making is going to have a focus on the horrors of American slavery and how it was shored up shamefully by Christians using arguments out of the Bible. And we'll also look at William Wilberforce, whose long campaign to abolish the transatlantic slave trade is, I'm not exaggerating here, just one of the most brilliant, noble things in Western history. Those stories are relatively well known, though, so we're not going to talk about them here. But some of the earlier groundwork for fighting slavery from the so-called Dark Ages and the medieval period is less familiar to us. Here's Rowan Williams again on that long fuse.
One of the typical bits of the stories of the saints and the great figures of the 4th and 5th centuries, when they have a religious conversion or when they decide they need to be more serious as Christians, they free their slaves. It's as if that, you know, that's one of the things you do if you want to show you're serious. You set your slaves free. And thinkers of the period, Greek and Latin, will at one point or another say, slavery is not natural. There are reasons for it. Perhaps it's a punishment for human sin. Perhaps it's a temporary arrangement. But it doesn't actually sit very well with the world we inhabit. Bit by bit, that moves on until in the Middle Ages you have, in St. Thomas Aquinas, the clear recognition that the rights, certain rights to decide your own future, cannot be taken away even by the institution of slavery. And by the 18th century, of course, you have the great anti-slavery movement, which is almost entirely the church's business. If the abolition of slavery had been left to enlightened secularists in the 18th century, we'd still be waiting.
It's not an overstatement, then, to say that it's because of the heritage of Christianity, the idea that every human being is made in God's image and is therefore of infinite value. It's because of that idea that slavery is universally condemned today. Of course, you don't have to be religious to think it's wrong, but it was Christianity that made it possible to think about humans in this way.
Slavery is now illegal everywhere in the world, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. One of the people that Simon got to interview for our documentary was Baroness Caroline Cox. She's a member of the House of Lords in the UK, and she's been involved for years in work of social justice and ending modern slavery through her organisation, Humanitarian Aid Relief Trust, or HART.
Yeah, she told me about going to South Sudan and meeting women and children who'd been forced into slavery during the terrible civil war that raged in that country between 1989 and 2005.
And in that war, his government abducted tens of thousands of women and children into slavery. It was our privilege to help to rescue some of those, a drop in the ocean, but several hundred. And I'll never forget talking to little Deng one day, a little lad aged about six, and he was crying because he just learnt that in the raid when he'd been abducted, both his parents had been killed, so he just discovered he was an orphan. Then towards the end of my time, the little Deng, he gave a wistful smile. He said, well, at least I'm home again now. I call my own name Deng, which is the Dinka word for rain, and rain is precious. He said, I'm no longer called a beet, or the Arabic for slave. But no child should be called slave in our world today. Yet still many, many thousands, maybe millions, are still enslaved in our world today.
It was these kinds of efforts to fight slavery that Rowan Williams pointed to when I asked him about whether the church today has something to contribute to the common good.
One of my most poignant memories is an evening in the Democratic Republic of Congo a few years ago with about 40 young people, all of whom had been abducted as children to work in militias of various kinds. They'd all been child soldiers. They'd all been brutalized. They'd all themselves been the victims of unspeakable violence, and they'd inflicted terrible things on others. They'd been drawn back into the village society because the churches had been there for them. One after another, they said, well, if it hadn't been for that, we'd still be living in hell. And when people ask me about the justification of the Christian church's existence, actually it's those people I think of.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. This episode on slavery was the final instalment of a four-part documentary sneak peek series. For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined is due for release next year. If you want to keep up with what's going on with that documentary, you can visit the project website to see what's happening and to sign up for updates. The URL is fortheloveofgodproject.com.
To catch up on part one of the series, The Evolution of the West, part two, The Crusades, and part three, Women, they're available on our website, publicchristianity.org, or why not subscribe to our podcast on iTunes? Just type CPX in the search box to find us. Next week, it's a change of pace. We speak with someone who was raised in a Jewish family, became an atheist at 14, joined the Communist Party, and then turned to Christianity. And his work has appeared in a list of 8 books that changed America. It's a fascinating story. You won't want to miss it. We'll see you then.